Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Folks, welcome. I'm back here in the corner. Hi, everyone. My name is John Hall. I'm going to be working with you guys over the next hour talking about virtual machines. We're still letting a few people in, so we'll be going in just a few minutes. I have such a big crowd today. Hey folks, so we're just getting a few last minute people here and then we get started. Just a couple quick housekeeping things. You guys have, I think I turned on just a little bit, getting a little feedback up here. So, you guys have eval forms in front of you. You just make sure to fill those out before you leave, before the session's over. And, if you need restrooms, they're out the door here. Make a right and you go down around the corner to the left. So it's a nice little, travel if you're thinking, hey, I'm bored, I want to walk around. So. Check. Okay. All right, that sounds a little bit better. Cool. And I'll stay away from the speakers. All right, everyone see me okay? I'm a walker, so I'm down here because I'm going to be walking back probably answer. And I'm a question taker. So we'll probably have lots of questions in the session. I'm really, I really like that kind of thing. If you have questions, please don't hesitate. We should have at some point some people that will have mics that can walk around, but I'm going to walk around too and talk to you, so... But let's go ahead and get started. We are here to talk about networking virtual machines in VI3 and how to get everything configured. We're going to be covering today some of the features in our vSwitches, connection types, policies, some of that kind of stuff. And we're going to also talk a little bit about the new IP storage stuff that we can connect up to now, iSCSI and NAS. So what I'd like to first start off with before we get into looking at connections and policies and that kind of thing is just a general networking scenario. So let's say this is your ESX server. I've got the VM kernel running on it. Got some virtual machines going. We've got a production VM you can see up there, NAT client, NAT router, service console connection. On the bottom, you can see the actual server cards. And I've got 3 gigi cards, a couple fast Ethernet cards, and then my actual physical network down here, a couple physical switches, and some different VLANs and stuff. So that's all cool. So what I need to do is I need to get my virtual machines connected out into the network, and I do that using virtual switches. So this is just one way we could have networked up. You can see they've got a standard production type of virtual switch on the left here where the production VM is going into the vSwitch, and the switch is going out to a single port out into the network. Over in the second example here, we see the NAT client and the NAT router. You can see the NAT router's multi-home between two switches. We've got an internal-only switch connecting the router and any clients that we might have. So everything stays internal, no way really to get to the client except through the router. And then we've got a connection out here on the service console that's going into this other switch that'll hook into like our management network. So a number of ways that we could connect this, and what I'm going to do over the next hour is I'm going to talk about the switch, talk about the connection types, talk about different ways that we can configure stuff, and of course also talk about IP storage. Alright, so let's start off by talking about this virtual switch construct, right? This is a construct within the kernel. When you create one, you specify how many ports you want. You can specify up to, as you can see here, 1,016 ports. You turn me down a little. 1,016 ports per switch. And it shows you here about traffic shaping. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Traffic shaping is a policy and that you can set when you're creating your vSwitches. In internal-only traffic, though, we don't really worry about traffic shaping. All the internal traffic is handled with CPU cycles, so there's not really any shaping that we would do on an Ethernet type of framework, like you'll see that we're going to do on stuff that's going out into your network. Internal-only switches. What do you suppose those are good for? So the obvious thing that we saw a second ago is if we had like a router and we've got some back-end clients like a NAT router, but you also could put a firewall and then set some applications behind the firewall. You could build like a web server, set your application and your database servers on the internal network. When you set stuff on an internal network like that, there's really no way to get to it unless you're going through the server that has access to those other servers. So one physical adapter, if we plug one physical adapter into a virtual switch, you're going to get standard network connectivity. And that's okay. But a lot of times a single adapter is not going to provide you with kind of bandwidth that you're looking for. And also if we're looking for any kind of redundancy or fault tolerance, then we want to take that into account too. You'll see here otherwise that it's pretty much the same as an internal switch. We can configure one with up to 1016 ports. Any internal traffic's handled by the CPU. Our virtual NICs in your virtual machines that are going to be connecting into these switches. They each have their own MAC addresses. So I get questions about that sometimes where you're configuring your virtual machines, you've got your external cards. Get people that say, hey, what's the IP address on this external adapter, right? And there really isn't any IP address on the external adapters. The external adapters act as pass-throughs, right? The MAC address is the one that has the IP address. So the packets get created at the MAC address, they get sent through the vSwitch out into the physical world, and they get passed through the adapter. So that's what we're looking at here. Internal traffic, again, handled by the CPU, and then the outbound traffic that we're sending through the adapter, we can employ some traffic shaping. So, again, I'll hit that policy when we get into the policy section. We'll take a look how that works. All right, so when we've got these external switches and we've got these internal switches, that's when we can build the types of network configurations I was talking about a second ago. In this example, we've got a Linux-based web server that is connected internally only to the database and the app server. So no way for a user to get to the database, get to the app server, got to go through the web server, and of course the web server is pulling from there. So
allows us to create within a single ESX box what normally might have taken you 2-3 servers in the physical world, right? So pretty cool. Alright, so we said before that when we're connecting to the external world, that maybe a single adapter is not enough. And that's when you would do this. You'd plug in multiple physical adapters as the outbound uplinks. And when we do that, we could create, using policies, a NIC team. And the NIC team will give us the additional bandwidth, will give us the failover capabilities that we would probably be looking for our higher-end applications. Again, outbound bandwidth, control of traffic shaping, every NIC's got its own MAC address. Load distribution is what we're going to be able to set up, and we have a cool new policy for that. So in ESX2, you could do load distribution. The default was by out MAC, which didn't distribute very well. Then you could change it to out IP, so you got better distribution, but you had to go look into the protocol stack, so you had a higher overhead. So now we got this new thing where you could set it by the port that you plug into on the vSwitch, determines which uplink you go out. So we get good distribution without having to look into the protocol stack at all. So no overhead, good distribution of traffic. I'll show you that in a little bit. It's very cool. And it's the default setting in VI3. Alright, so any questions so far? Okay. Alright, so when we create a vSwitch, there are three different types of connections that we can put on one. And I'm showing you those connections here. So the blue piece here, my virtual switch construct, and I've got a service console port, which we're going to use, of course, for management. I have a VM kernel port. VM kernel port's used for what? Yeah, so vMotion and also IP storage connectivity, right? And then finally, your virtual machine port groups. Those are your third connection type, and those are what your virtual machines are going to plug into. And here we've created different port groups. You could create a single port group and be done with it, but you would create separate port groups here if we need to apply different policies. One of the most common policies that would be different would be your VLANs. If you have external VLANs and they're different and you need to be able to connect to each one, then you would need to create a separate port group for each VLAN that you're going to be plugging into. And then there's additional policies that we can apply to, so we'll take a look at those. All right, so let's start off by talking about the Service Console port connection. Service Console, we've defined one on this virtual switch. You're going to connect it into your management network. It needs to have visibility, of course, back to the ESX server. And to Virtual Center, to your other ESX servers, should be able to see those guys too. Then the second one we've got here is your VM kernel port. That guy we're going to use to, again, do vMotion or to plug into IP storage or both. And then you've got your VM port groups. So here it shows that we've defined three port groups within the virtual switch. Make them look like switches, but port groups, right? And each one of these would have maybe separate settings for VLAN IDs or for NIC teaming, depending on how many uplinks we put into the port groups, stuff like that. So I'll show you how that all works. Let's first take a look at how you create the different kinds of connections we're talking about here. So I go into a virtual switch, I edit the settings on the virtual switch, and I'm going to get this. This is going to tell me, hey, what kind of connection do we want to put on? Do we want to add a virtual machine port group? Do we want to create a VM kernel port? Or do we want to create a service console port? VM kernel ports, service console ports require IP addresses. So make sure that you've got everything networked correctly. You've got IP addresses for those guys that are valid on the network. We'll tell you usually when you create a service console or a VM kernel port, and you get to the section where it lists the network cards, will tell you the network card is on. Remember, again, it doesn't have an IP address, right? But we can still go out and say this is on the 10.1.10 network or 192.168.100 network. We could tell you what network it's on so that you can go in and supply the appropriate IP addresses for your VM kernel or your service console. So I have a question here.
One seven three. Yeah,
172. Okay, so creating the vSwitch itself doesn't really get you connected to the outside world. It's picking which uplink you're going to go to, and the uplink is on a network, right? So in the example that you're giving me, which just so everyone could hear, the question we were talking about here was created a vSwitch, went out an uplink, and the uplink gave a bogus address, 173.001. So normally what you should see in the configuration is the network that card's on. So if the network shows up right, then I wouldn't expect really to see that. If the network isn't showing up right, then maybe there's some kind of connectivity issue. Maybe go back and check like DNS and routing just to make sure that we can see everything. Maybe go to the ESX server, do some pings, and make sure you can ping out, that kind of thing. Because it sounds like something's misconfigured in terms of the network itself, where it goes out and tries to look. Because we normally pick up the network tables from your switches, right? So maybe something in the switch table or... Other questions? Yes. How does trunking change which? Okay, in terms of the IP address, or so the card usually knows the network because it goes out and checks the table, comes back, says, hey, here's the network I'm on, and then you just need to supply an IP address. Of course, it's up to you to make sure that you got a valid IP address in the network and everything. Yeah, so, okay, now that part's different, right? If you've got external VLANs, those don't usually show up in the config, so you need to know which one you plug into, and then I'll show you in a second, you go into policies, and you say, hey, for VLAN, I need this VLAN ID number, and, or if you're configuring a service console or VM kernel port on the same screen where you plug in the IP address, it asks you if there's a VLAN ID that you need to supply. Any other questions? Okay. See, I got a good group, question asking group. I like that.
What kind of interface do we get from each of these virtual switches? So I got to imagine that the more that you put out there, the more expensive it's going to get. Is there a limit or a threshold where we want to stay under that? Or?
Well, in theory, like we showed you here, we could plug in like 1,000 ports. So obviously, if we try to route 1,000 ports to like one uplink, eventually you're going to have some serious issues to deal with, right? And we don't really stop you from doing that. I mean, we could provide you metrics so you could see, hey, it looks like I got too much stuff going through there. I need to add another NIC or something like that. But we don't really stop you in any way from trying to make that type of configuration. Now, give me your question again so I can finish answering it.
Basically, I was just trying to understand how you mentioned that all of these virtual switches are handled by the CPU on the box. Well, how expensive is that?
Well, that's only really internal communication that's CPU. So if I'm talking to another virtual machine on the same ESX server, I'm not going to create packets. I'm just going to do CPU cycles to communicate.
Gotcha.
If I'm going out the box, then I create packets for that.
So the overhead's pretty good.
Yeah. Unless you're doing like a ton of internal traffic, and then you probably want to take a look.
How secure is it sharing using multiple virtual machines to the same virtual switch at the same network?
So what I would say about that is if you're doing that, and you're probably then already in an environment where you're using VLANs, and then I would apply the VLAN policy. So you create separate port groups. Let's say you've got three VLANs, 103, 104, 105. Then you'd go in and create a port group for 103, a port group for 104, a port group for 105. Every virtual machine I plug into the port group that has the VLAN ID of 103 will get tagged with that VLAN ID after at least the virtual switch. So when it goes out into your physical network, it's in the right spot and no one else sees it that's outside of that VLAN. Yeah, so I'm sorry. So the question up here was about security, right? And so we were talking about VLAN IDs and the fact that when you apply a VLAN ID policy to a port group that you create, we said the three things you could create here. The first one there is a virtual machine port group. When I create one of those, that is a group that I can plug virtual machines into. And I can apply policies to that group, and one of the policies I can apply is a VLAN ID. So if I have an external VLAN ID in the network, and I want to connect into that, then I supply that as a policy, and there's my security, right? Now it's going to get tagged when it goes into the virtual switch, or at least the VM goes into the virtual switch, gets tagged there, goes out into your physical network. When it comes back and it hits the vSwitch, we strip the ID, and then goes back into the virtual machine. There's very little overhead on the tagging and untagging process that we do inside the box.
What about if you combine that with, like, like, for instance, if you're doing aggregation, you're doing 802.3ad, you aggregate your trunk, you know, you bring it all together, and then you've got VLAN tagging within that.
Yeah. So here's the thing. So Jeff is talking. So Jeff's question here was talking about link aggregation. Right? So link aggregation comes in like two flavors. There's us aggregating the links going out, and then there would be some kind of two-way switch-assisted link aggregation, right? And so we have somewhat minimal support for two-way switch-assisted link aggregation. So, you know, you'd have to check and see whatever patch release you have, whether we currently support whatever switch you're working with. Generally speaking, we haven't done a lot with link aggregation that's two-way at all. So
we're using the Cisco switch.
Yes.
I can't find anywhere to do the channelize. Let's say I have four cable connected to two switch.
Right.
I can't really channelize using four cable as one logical four.
So that this question is going back to what we're talking about. This is talking about a Cisco switch and setting up channels, fast ether channel, right? So this goes again to the fact that you can go into the interface here and you can set up multiple networks, NICs and load distribution outbound, but we don't have a facility right now to do two-way switch-assisted load balancing. So yeah, so there you go. Yes. That's correct. So if we have external VLAN IDs, and so the ticket here is whether you have a lot or not. Like, let's say, for example, that my ESX server is plugging into a VLAN, and it's only ever going to communicate inside that VLAN. If that's the case, I don't need to set a VLAN policy here, because it'll get tagged at the physical switch, right? And it'll all have the same VLAN ID, and that's all good. If, on the other hand, I'm creating VMs that are going to have to go to multiple VLANs in my network, right? I'm creating virtual machines. I think I said VLAN twice. So I'm creating virtual machines on my server. They're going to need to go out to multiple VLANs. Then I'm going to need to create multiple port groups and assign a separate VLAN ID to each port group, plug my VMs into that, and then they'll get tagged internally in the box and go out into the right VLAN. So that's the question. You're going to do it internally if you have multiple external VLANs you need to communicate with. You're going to do it externally if you have if everything's in the same VLAN. Yeah, so I'm not going to talk a lot about vMotion here. The question was about vMotion naming. But yeah, vMotion is definitely really tricky to set up in terms of that it looks at the target and it says, hey, I'm going to vMotion from my host to the target. When I get to the target, I expect to be able to plug back into everything I was plugged into. And so it's got a table that says the name of the switch that I was plugged into is this, right? So if you had it named something else, it's going to have a problem reconnecting. So you want to make sure that stuff works. I can't stress how important that is because your DRS stuff all works based off of vMotion. If vMotion doesn't work, DRS will never give you a recommendation to move something because it knows underneath that vMotion doesn't work and I really can't move it, right? So DRS normally is going to look around and say, I could move it over there and I'd get better performance. But if vMotion isn't working and I can't move it over there, I would just never recommend anything to you. And you'd be wondering, hey, what's wrong with my DRS? And it's really not to do with DRS. It has to do with your vMotion config.
There's still a limit of virtual NICs.
Number of virtual NICs. So we'll start there. I think I know what your actual question, though, is, Todd. So Todd wondered if there's a limit on virtual NICs per virtual machine. So every virtual machine that you have has a 440 chipset on it that's capable of six PCI slots. Once taken up by the graphics adapter, that leaves five virtual PCI slots we can link into. And so you can have, within the five there, up to four NICs, up to four SCSI adapters, some combination of that that doesn't go over five, right? So that, but usually you never really need more than two virtual NICs, and you don't even need two unless you're multi-home routing. If you're just going out into your network, you really only need one because it's the virtual switch that will have multiple uplinks going into that'll distribute the traffic. So that goes to, do we still have the same number of NICs on the ESX server as our support rules. And the answer there is right now, yes. We still support X number of NICs based on a credit system. It's 16 on 10100 or 8 gig, yeah, right, or a combination of that. So, yeah, that's still the same. One thing that is different, and please don't go quoting me on this because this number changes a lot, and we haven't really published anything like this. But we've gotten about a 30% improvement in our networking performance from ESX2 to VI3. So definitely, if you haven't gone to VI3 yet and you're doing a lot of networking, it'll make a lot of sense for you. You'd see a lot of improvement. Part of that has to do with us going and making updates to the virtual NIC driver that's in VMware Tools. And then part of it has to do with what we've gone in and done with the VM kernel. Also with being able to bring all the hardware into the VM kernel instead of splitting it out like we used to do in ESX2. We don't do that anymore, right? Kernel owns everything. So that gives us a little bit more control, too. So the end result is when we did some testing after we got everything all said and done, had some really nice numbers. So. Yes. So again, the NIC teaming is done with the external NICs, right? So it's just a matter of creating the switch and then plugging NICs into it. Then you create a port group. The port group's, anything you plug into the port group is going to take advantage of your NIC teaming. So all your VMs that you plug into your virtual machine port group, when they go out, they'll take advantage of the NIC teaming. They'll have the load distribution, the failover capabilities, all of that kind of stuff.
So, but if you have a different virtual machine that was using the NIC, the physical NIC, by
right.
itself,
yeah, but that's something you do have to be concerned with. So the question here is if I had a physical NIC and I was running some VM traffic through it and now I put more VM traffic on it, is that something to be concerned about? And sure it is, right? I mean, you're going to need to monitor. And you could use, probably the best way to do this would be to use some kind of network load tool like Iometer. Iometer is something you go download off the website. Off of the internet, and it's free, and it'll generate network traffic, and so you could run it to see what kind of bandwidth you have available, right? And then you could make sure you don't overload it, know when you reach your limit, right? And then if we reach the limit, we could add more NICs maybe to increase the overall bandwidth capabilities. All right, let me continue on for a little bit. I'll take some more questions in a little. One more.
VLAN tag ports, VLAN tagging.
Yes.
Right now,
right.
We needed to add three different subnets on there. You know, we have to technically add three more ports so we can configure net. Can we set it up to a tagged port so we use the subnet that...
Yeah, so let me wait till I get to a slide that shows a good example of what you're talking about, and then I'll talk about it. But basically what the question was here, and this goes back to what we talked about with VLANs. When you set up a VLAN, I can either create a virtual machine port group, and I can assign a VLAN to it. And if I do that, everything I plug into that is going to get tagged with that VLAN. Or I can plug stuff into a port group, and then I can plug an external adapter in it, let it go out into the network, and then it would get tagged by whatever VLAN it's plugged into physically in the network. So in the question that you have here, we may want to do that and let it just go ahead and get tagged by what it's plugged into. And then when we create the virtual switches, just create different virtual switches and plug the NICs that go to the different VLANs in there, and everything gets tagged appropriately. So, but let's take a look when we get to that screen. I'll show you what I'm talking about. All right, so we're going in here. We're defining our connections. And this is what it's going to look like in the VI client. So if you go in the VI client, you go to the configuration tab, which is new, right? The configuration tab shows us the configuration for the ESX host. And you go to the networking, you're going to see the gray things in the middle there. Those are my virtual switch constructs. And to the left of them are the connections I've made so far. So port groups, service console ports, VM kernel ports, all on the left. On the right are the NICs that I'm patched into to go out and talk in the world. Your vSwitch, when you create one, you're going to give it a name. And so you can see here that we've used a naming convention that's vSwitch 0, 1, 2. You can call them whatever you want, so you don't have to use that kind of convention. But it makes it kind of easier when you get in, because the other thing that you're seeing here is the Service Console port connection. So in ESX2, our Service Console port connection was what? So ETH0 is what we're looking for there, right? The Service Console connection was owned by the Linux side, right? And it was using ETH0, ETH1, and it's the first connection, so it's ETH0, right? And then we couldn't really take advantage of the ability to go in and nick team and have some failover capabilities, right? Didn't really need the additional bandwidth, but failover would have been nice. So now we got that problem fixed, because again we said the VM kernel owns everything, so there is no ETH0, ETH1. Instead now we have a thing called a virtual switch interface, and that's what that vSwif stands for, virtual switch interface. When we create a service console port, we're going to create one of these, and then we're going to patch it to the switch, and that's going to allow us to get out into the world. And these are visible from the ESX server console. If I go in, like with PuTTY or something, I can take a look at these. What you'd use is the new master config command, which is ESX CFG, ESX config. So ESX CFG dash vSwif if you want to look at vSwif stuff, or vSwitch if you want to look at vSwitch stuff. Any other questions on connections before I start talking about policies? Yeah, that's a good question, Jeff. So the question was VLANs and VMXNet, right? When you went in and what we had before at ESX2, if you went into a virtual machine, is we'd start you off with VLANs, which VLANs correlated to an AMD PCNet adapter, which you could find that in like every operating system package ever, right? So it was good for setting up the OS. Then once you got set up to the OS, we changed over to VMXNet, which is our higher speed virtualized driver that's included with VMware tools. But that was a manual process. You had to go in and do that yourself. And the good news with VI3 is you don't have to do that anymore. We have a morphing adapter now. So you set it up when you're doing the installation, and it automatically switches over to VMXNet when it's done. You don't have to go in and do anything. Okay, so let's talk now about the policies that we can assign to these connections that we've been looking at. And those policies fall into four different categories. They are VLAN, security, traffic shaping, and nick teaming. And we can define them at the switch-wide level. So let's say, for example, that everything on the switch was going out VLAN ID 104. We could set a policy like that. Or everything's going to go out through three nicks, so we need to set up our load distribution. We could set that up. Or we could set different port groups. Like, let's say on the same virtual switch, I got some stuff that's going to go through 103, some stuff that's going to go through VLAN 104, stuff that's going to go through 105. I could set up three separate port groups, each with its own VLAN ID policy, and then when I plug virtual machines in it, they go to the right place. So let's start off talking, which I know we've kind of already talked a little bit about, but the VLAN policy, right? VLANs are one of the things you're probably most, you know, going to have to go in and configure, because most of the time you're going to have VLANs out in your physical network already, and you need to communicate on those VLANs, so we need to go in and set stuff up. So what we do is we go in. Oh, I mentioned here kind of what VLANs are, so probably everyone in here already knows. But virtual LAN is what we're talking about. What we're doing is splitting up your physical LAN into smaller virtual networks, and each network that we split it into is secure in that everything I send within that network is not visible to anything else. Particularly important maybe like in our IP storage stuff now. Like let's say I've got a nice SCSI device. If it's within that VLAN, then no one else sees it. Right? And then we're also limiting broadcast traffic so that it stays within the VLAN that we created. So again, you're probably going to have them already out there. We need to go ahead and connect into them. And so this is what we would do. We go to the virtual switch, and we create two port groups. We create one that's got VLAN 105, one that's got VLAN 106, and then the virtual machines get plugged into those port groups. And then when we send traffic out, the traffic when it hits the virtual switch is tagged with the VLAN ID, and then it's sent on passing through the physical NIC into your physical switch and out into the network world. When it comes back, it hits the virtual switch, and that's where it's stripped of the VLAN ID and sent on to the VM.
Is
there
a concept of a default VLAN?
Yeah, so a lot of times it's like VLAN 1 is like your default. So that brings up like a whole lot of questions. The first thing I think of is, if that's the only VLAN we have, which some configurations are like that, everything's on VLAN 1 and that's it, then fine, you don't have to set up any policies here at all, just let it get tagged by the external switch. But if you have VLAN 1 and then you have a bunch of other VLANs, that's still fine. When you set the policy up, you can supply any ID from 0 up. So I can supply 1 for one port group, and I can supply the other IDs. Now, what we don't do is like what a lot of switches do. A lot of switches, you define an ID and everything else is automatically 1. Here, if I define an ID and I have some other stuff that was plugged into the switch and I don't plug it in to one port group that has an ID assigned, then you have no more communication.
Well,
go ahead.
If I have 3 port groups, 2 of them assign VLAN IDs and 1 I do not,
right,
go out with no tagging?
That's correct.
Okay, and that would be my default VLAN on a Cisco device.
Right, well, yeah, should be. Okay. So you should be okay there.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so some other stuff that we've added in. This is new in VI3. We added some security stuff so you can get an additional layer of security on the ESX server. And what you can do in the port groups that you create is you can go in and set promiscuous mode, MAC address changes, and forged transmit settings. You can see here what the default settings are. Promiscuous mode, and let me actually click forward and see if I have this. No, I don't. Okay, so I'll describe it real quick. Promiscuous mode, when you turn it on, instead of just seeing packets that were meant for the adapter, you see all the packets on the network. Usually the only time you ever turn promiscuous mode on is if you're doing some intrusion detection or you're doing some other kind of network checking. And so here you would just go in, turn it on, do your stuff, turn it back off. The other two things on here, MAC address changes or forged transmits, these could happen by a malicious, or they could happen normally. So some software will make changes to MAC addresses or to your transmits. They'll actually pretend to be somebody else when they go out. And if that's the case, then you want to leave these at the default. That's why we have left them at the default. But if you don't have anything like that, then also maliciously somebody could go in and pretend to be this virtual machine and then get access to your network. So if we reject these, then we'll take a look at your MAC addresses, we'll take a look at your transmits and make sure they're coming from the right source. Alright, one of the network policies we could set is traffic shaping. And what's nice about this is I could set traffic shaping as a general rule for a port group, for the whole port group. Then I just plug VMs in and they get the policy, right? So in this example, you can see that there's 3 things you set for traffic shaping. What I'm doing is making sure that a virtual machine that maybe has a bursting network application doesn't run off with all the network bandwidth, starve the other VMs, and then we start to do contention-based share stuff, which is all bad, right? We don't want that. So if we know that we have a bursting network application, we can throttle the amount of bandwidth that's allowed to get. Now it's not going to be able to go and take too much, and everybody else is going to have enough. And so that's what we're doing here. We're taking 3 values. How much average bandwidth is this VM allowed to have? How much is it allowed to have during peak activity? And what's the burst size? And then we put those in here. So you can see the traffic shaping tag. I've turned it on, supplied those values. Now every VM I plug in is going to get those. Any questions on that? Pretty effective. It used to be that you had to go in and apply this VM by VM, you know. So now it's cool. You can put it in a whole port group and everybody's going to get the setting. Okay, NIC teaming we count as another policy setting because there's different things you can set when you create a NIC team. All a NIC team is we've got more than one uplink port on this virtual switch that we're going out to, and we'd like to take those and we'd like to route traffic in a load balanced fashion through those uplink ports and maybe also do some failover. So you can see here a lot of things we could set. And let me see what we've got. All right, so I actually do have all those settings coming up on a slide. So let me start here by taking a look and showing you what we've got. In VI3, we have a new policy I mentioned, which is called vSwitch port-based. And you can see I've got four VMs up on the top. Those four VMs are going to plug into a port on the switch. We said you can have up to 1,000 ports on a virtual switch, right? 1016 to be exact. So here we're going to plug into a port. Based on what port we plug into determines what NIC we go out on. So you can see the first virtual machine is going out the first NIC. Oops. Sorry, pressed the wrong button there. The second virtual machine is going out the second NIC here. And the third NIC, since it's multi-homed. Virtual machine 2 is going out through the first NIC. And virtual machine 3 is going out through the second NIC. So good load distribution, simply based on what port we're plugged into here. And so we're not looking at our packets at all, so no overhead really to speak of. This is the default setting. Honestly, can't see any reason to go change it. In ESX2, I was always like, you're going to need to change to IP to get decent distribution, even though you got a little overhead. But here, there's no overhead, and you get good distribution, and so changing it to anything else is just going to impact your network performance. All right, so here are the other two things you could set, though. You could set outMAC. OutMAC says I'm going to look at the source MAC address and use that to determine where I'm going. The problem with using outMAC is if you're in a routed network, on the routers, we can't see past the router, so we're going to send everything through the same adapter that's going there. And you can see here that I'm going to get some fairly poor connection. My VM up here that's communicating with clients on the other side of the router using the same adapter for both clients there. And then my other VM is using another adapter to go to the local client. So you can see that I've actually got my third NIC not in use at all. So not good distribution. What I could do is change it to IP-based, and then we look into the protocol stack, look at the IP address. I'm going to get good distribution this way, but I have overhead, and this is a challenge we were faced with in ESX2. We've eliminated that now in VI3 because we use the port group based. Whatever port we're plugged into on the vSwitch determines what NIC we go out on. All right, so when we work with doing load distribution, you know, one side is load balancing, the other side is fault tolerance. And so you can see here that there's a number of things we can set in fault tolerance. The first one is the link state. And you got two options with link state. You got link state only or link state plus beaconing. And you can look at link state as like reactive or proactive. If you leave it set to link state only, then we don't know that there's a connectivity problem until we try to send through that connection and it doesn't work. Then we know. If, on the other hand, you have link state plus beaconing, then we go check the connections periodically, ping out, see if everything is running. And so we could proactively tell you if you had a down connection. Sounds good, right? The only downside here, your network guys, a lot of times, they don't like the extra traffic produced by beaconing. And so a lot of times you should check with those guys first, and they'll probably say, no, you're not allowed to have beaconing. And so you'll just have to go with the reactive. A lot of times that, because beaconing generates a lot of activity on the network, and a lot of times kind of confuses everything for your network admin dudes. Okay, failover. So failover says, I got a NIC, I'm transmitting through it right now. The NIC loses connectivity for some reason or goes bad or whatever. So I need to switch over to another NIC. And we can control the policy on how that happens. And there's two basic ways that we can do that. We can either do it according to an explicit list. So you use an explicit list if I have some gigi cards and some fast Ethernet cards. Because I'm going to want the failover to go to a gigi card unless there are no more gigi cards left. So I would make a list where all my gigi cards come first, my fast Ethernet cards come last. If you don't choose to do an explicit failover, then the system will keep a rolling list of who's been up the longest and will set your connection over to the next adapter that's been up the longest if you lose connectivity. So, any questions on that? Yes, so I've got a question in the back. So here's what I'd have to check. So yeah, I'm aware of it, but I couldn't tell you why it was created in the first place, right? So what I'd have to do is go back and see. If it was, for example, created because of sharing or ownership of the adapter, of the management adapter, then that's eliminated. We now the VM kernel owns everything. But if it was created to handle some of their systems or some of their network ports, then I'd have to go and take a look. Now I can tell you that in VI3, we eliminated like all the driver problems we had in ESX2 with Broadcom and stuff like that. So most likely, if it was a parameter put in due to a problem, it's been eliminated. But let me check for you. So maybe get with me after, and I'll take a look and see what maybe I can get your email, and I can send a request to engineering, find out what's going on. And
for the naming stuff, yeah.
The question here is, if you're doing NIC teaming, is there any configuration required on the external switches? So right now we don't do any kind of two-way or switch-assisted load balancing, so no. You just set the stuff on the outbound side, that's it.
Okay, and also by these switch port base,
yes?
Do you set which group of ports will go out which NIC?
Yes. So I'm going to show you that in a minute. The question here is, if you create multiple vSwitch port groups, can you determine which uplink port we're going to use on that port group? And the answer is yes. I'm going to show you that in a minute, because when I see all the uplink ports, I can choose the order that I want to use them in. So I can say these are the active ports, these are the standby ports. And then so I would normally use these ports for communication, but if they go down for some reason, then go ahead and let me use the other stuff.
So
it'd balance across all the active ports. It would not normally use the standby ports. Yes, so you can, that's how it works. Like if we do everything by the port that you're plugged into. The port that you're plugged into determines what NIC you're going to use on the outside. And we use a fairly simple algorithm where we do the port mod 1, and that determines which NIC we're going to use. So let me get that for you when we break, okay? Any other questions? Yes.
Web applications, having your service console and your secure network, and deploying DMZs to basically set up web servers.
Yeah, so that kind of goes back to what we were showing earlier, is that we can use this internal vSwitch construct, right? And anything we put on the internal vSwitch is not visible to anybody unless we physically plug them in, right? Unless I plug that VM into this internal switch, nobody sees it. It has to go through your web app or through the DMZ or through your firewall, yeah, in order to get to those machines that are on the back end or on that internal-only switch. So that's generally the way we control that kind of stuff, and it's pretty rock solid. There's like, once you put something on an internal switch that's connected like through like a router or a firewall or something like that, there is no way to get to that unless you go through the other VM.
Okay. Well, right now we're looking at deploying a Blade Center, and everything is trunked, right? So potentially you're going to have your service console traffic, your vMotion traffic, and VLANs that are extended to your DMZs to deploy virtual machines for database servers, web servers, et cetera.
Sure.
And I'm not exactly comfortable with doing that, but...
Well, okay, so your service console port and your VM kernel port, they're not in the port group. Right, so when you put stuff into the port group, it's going to stay in the port group. Let's say this is your internal only switch, right? So I put things in the port group, they can talk to each other, but you're not going to be able to talk into them unless you go through whatever's plugged in externally. So if the only thing you plug out externally is your firewall or something, then that's the only way we would get there. And the service console and the VM kernel ports are not part of that group, so. Now, you could, if you wanted to further do it, you could use VLAN IDs, set your port group to one VLAN ID, set your service console and your VM kernel ports to separate VLAN IDs. That would give you a further layer of security, too. All right, folks. So let me get you in just a second here. I still got quite a bit to talk through here. All right, so this goes to the question I got earlier, which was, if I have port groups and I've got a bunch of uplinks. Can I control which uplinks I use? And you can see here that I've got 6 uplinks, and I've set A and B to be my active uplinks for port group 1, which is ports 1 to 3. I've set C and D to be my active uplinks for ports 4 through 8, and E and F to be my active uplinks for ports 9 through 14. And then the other port groups are standard. Are standard, standby. So they won't be used by, so in the first example, ports 1 through 3 will use A and B. They won't touch C through F unless there's a link failure on A and B and it fails over to one of those ports. Okay, so I'm going to talk about IP storage. And when we talk about IP storage, there's 2 things that we're talking about, right? Talking about iSCSI, talking about NAS. So new places that we can store VMs on. So, of course, we've got to get that stuff configured. So iSCSI. I got a quick, what is it slide, right? So right now you're using your ESX server. If you have a SAN, you're transporting SCSI over fiber channel, right? Encapsulated within the fiber channel protocol. Same concept here, right? We're transporting SCSI, but now we're encapsulating it within TCP/IP. And we're sending it across your IP network. It's going to your iSCSI device and back, right? You have things called initiators and things called targets. Your initiators are your servers. Your targets are your storage devices. And so when we take a look at how we can use iSCSI with ESX, we can do a lot with iSCSI. We can boot off of it if we want to. We can create a data store in an iSCSI LUN. We can set up raw device maps to an iSCSI LUN, do vMotion migration, almost everything. There's a couple little things you can't do. Cluster or VCB we don't support yet because we haven't fully tested them. But everything else pretty much works here. This is what the components in an iSCSI network look like. You've got your ESX server, which is either going to use hardware initiators, or you can set up a software initiator. We have a software initiator in there that was supplied by Cisco. And we go through the IP network, and we go to our storage array. And the array is not that much different from a fiber channel array. It's still got physical disks configured in LUNs that are getting presented out processor ports, just like a fiber channel SAN would. Addressing's a little different, right? We don't have worldwide names, which is what we have for addressing in fiber channel. What we have here instead is iSCSI qualified names, or IQNs. So you can see our target here is IQN with the date, with the vendor, and then you can see you can alias. I like aliasing because I don't have to remember all the long names. I can just make short names. So I have store1 as my storage. I have train1 as my server. Good to go. Once you've got that stuff configured, the way you find your storage is you do a thing called send targets. Send targets requires you to know the IP address of one storage box, but as long as you know one, it'll go talk to that and say, hey, what other storage do you know about? And the iSCSI device will say, I know about this other stuff on the network, and it'll all come back to you and will get populated in the database and represented in the VI client. iSCSI, we do multipathing just like we do with fiber channel. Fiber channel is handled based on your HBAs. We do routing through the network, or if you're using the software initiator, or we use HBAs if you're doing the hardware stuff. Either way, when we're doing multipathing here, there's 2 policies that you can set generally for multipathing. One is most recently used, the other is fixed. The only one we currently support with iSCSI is most recently used. Haven't really had a chance to play around too much with fixed. So the guys are still working on that. This is what the hardware versus the software. You can see on the hardware side, we have a QLA 4010 QLogic adapter. The advantage of using a hardware adapter is it has a TCP/IP offload engine, which will perform a lot of the packetizing, depacketizing type of work. And so the kernel doesn't have to go do that work. If you do it in software, the kernel has to do all the work, so it's going to place, depending on how much of this stuff you're doing, going to place some stress on your ESX box. You can set up the software initiator. It's fairly simple. You go in, first of all, and create a VM kernel port, since your VM kernel port is the one you need for IP storage, and it needs to be on the same network, either physically placed on the same vSwitch or routed. So it needs to be on the same network as your service console port, and they both need to be able to see your iSCSI adapter. I'm sorry, your iSCSI storage device, what I was looking for there. All right, then we go in to your security. So you've got a security profile that controls the firewall on the ESX server, and we need to open up the iSCSI client. So we go in and check that so that we can get out that port. Then we go into the iSCSI software adapter. You can see it here. And we need to configure it. So the first thing we need to do is enable it. When we enable it, it's going to automatically generate an iSCSI qualified name, an IQN, and it'll show up in the box down here. And you can see it up here under iSCSI name. We can alias it. So in this case, I'm calling it with a fully qualified domain name, so that makes it easy for me to get. And I'm going to do a send targets to get information about the storage. So you see here, to do the send targets, I need to know the IP address of at least one iSCSI device and put in the port, and then I'm going to get information back about what storage we have. Now, generally, we recommend when you're using iSCSI storage that you do everything through a dedicated storage network. If you're using a mixed network, then we have a facility where you can enable CHAP authentication so that we don't transmit anything in clear text that would be seen by the other traffic on the network. But again, we would prefer you have a dedicated storage network for this to give you better overall performance. All right, so we do a send targets. We find the ones. You can see here on the right-hand side on the bottom, we found a NetApp device called Burton. And we've got some various ones, five ones that we found on that device. So a couple of little iSCSI tips and tricks. Of course, you need to make sure that you open up the firewall for this to work. Set up a naming convention for IQN. You can use QLogic's SAN server software to set up the 4010 if you're using the hardware adapter. And it shows you here how you would install that SAN server software using a shell script. All right, last thing to talk about here would be NAS and NFS. So that's our other IP storage, right? And a NAS-based device is, you know, for file shares and for prints, but these days those devices are doing a lot more. And we may want to use some of that storage. Now, a NAS device a lot of times has got other stuff hitting it. There's a lot of traffic already. I generally don't recommend running VMs on it unless they're test or development or project type of VMs. But it's a great place to store ISOs, templates, that kind of thing. Okay. So to set it up, it's fairly straightforward. We can go in. Specifically, we're doing NFS. So if you have a NAS box, NAS boxes can do NFS. Or they can also do SIFS, which are the two basic ways that we could send protocols. NFS is more common in Unix, SIFS more common in Windows. And so we're going to use NFS, so you'll need to make sure when you create a file share on the NAS box that we're going to access, that you tell it it's NFS that we're going to use for the protocol. And once we create the data store, and this is not really a VMFS data store we're creating, you could say it's a NAS data store that we're creating. But on that data store, you can run VMs, you can store ISOs, templates, stuff like that. And even vMotion. This is what your NAS looks like. Basically, I just go up on the NFS server here. I create a share. So I've made one here called /ISO. And then we go down on the virtual switch. We make that VM kernel port, which gives us the IP storage. And then I go in and add the data store using the SharePoint that we've got there. You can see underneath that there's some stuff that needs to be there, but that stuff's handled automatically by the VI client. We put it in read-write mode so we can read and write to the share. We make sure that we can perform stuff as root, and we sync up. So that's what you see down on the bottom. There's our port, so we do have to, of course, have a defined port for VM kernel. Then we go in and we give it the IP address of the NAS box, what folder on the NAS box we want. If it was maybe templates or ISOs and we wanted it in read-only, we could do that. Tell it what NAS data store name we want, and then it's going to show up in our list of data stores like you see here on top. Okay, so I know I had powered through the last part of that to make sure we were done on time, but I'm here for the next hour or so. If you have questions for me, hang out. I'd be more than happy to talk with you, answer anything you have. If you haven't already filled out your eval, please take a second, go ahead and fill that out for us. We would really appreciate that.
Can we get the slides?
Yeah, so slides are going to be, let me go one more thing. They will be available, it's on the bottom here, when we have all the sessions posted. And then this is the username and password you would need to download those. So I'm going to leave this up there so that you can jot that down. I imagine the sessions all get posted towards the end of the week, so just keep an eye out.